A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Well, perhaps 1977 at the Stanley Warner Theater on Route 4 in Paramus, New Jersey. I remember going with my buddies to see Star Wars. Now, some of you may have heard that there is another movie in this juggernaut of pop culture coming out. Everyone's been talking about it. There was a new ad broadcast during last week's Monday Night Football game, and so many people went online to watch the trailer and then to buy tickets that, in the words of the newspapers, the internet broke. Well done, George Lucas. Now, this story, this mythological universe, holds the attention and the affections of millions of people around the world. And there are a variety of reasons for that. I remember when my friends and I went to see that first movie oh so long ago, we were impressed by the special effects. There had been nothing like them before. And even I, as a teenager, was smart enough to know that you can't go wrong when you've got Alec Guinness playing a leading role in the movie. And then there was Harrison Ford with his youthful sass, giving birth to a film persona that we would enjoy over the decades. But I think the reason the movie resonated with so many people, and still does to this day, is that it's just a good piece of storytelling. Lucas followed a narrative model. It was one that became very popular during the 1930s with film serials, but it actually has a far older provenance. You have a hero, often somebody of no stature. And that person has some friends. And something bad happens. And in that moment, they find their inner strength, their mettle, and they go forth and have a series of adventures and misadventures. They fight evil. They defeat the bad guys. And then there is a happy ending. That, with a lot of space battles and explosions, is Star Wars. And indeed, that is the arc of the first three movies, the trilogy that George Lucas created from 1977 to 1983. The third movie, The Return of the Jedi, ends with the rebel forces having finally defeated the dreaded Empire. And the final victory is made possible because Darth Vader, the big bad villain throughout the movies, resolves his conflict with his son, Luke Skywalker. If you did not know about this relationship, I apologize for spoiling this after all these decades. There at the climactic battle where Luke is facing off with the Emperor, it looks like our hero is going down. And Darth Vader has to make a choice. And he chooses to save his son. The movie ends with a big celebration, and on the side there is a funeral for Darth Vader who has died. It's all lovely and it's all touching. It's a happy ending. But it is hollow. Darth Vader does not deserve a happy ending. If you paid attention through the movies, Darth Vader has killed billions of people. But that narrative dynamic took hold, and it had to come to its supposedly logical conclusion. The package has to be wrapped up, the bow has to be nicely tied. And so Darth Vader gets to be a good guy again. Now, I engage in my amateurish film critique this morning because I think that this can help us approach this final chapter of Jonah. Lots of people vaguely recall this book. There's this guy. Things are going pretty well for him in life. Then there's some conversation that takes place up in heaven, and everything goes south for Job. Loses his wealth, family dies, he becomes sick, argues with his friends, has an interesting conversation with the Lord himself. And then at the end, everything is made right again. In fact, it's even better. He has more cattle, more kids, more money. He lives a long life. It's a happy ending. That's what we can think if we give this chapter a cursory reading. If we don't pay attention to the details. If we're willing to spend some time with the text, though, and be attentive, we can see there's some interesting stuff going on here. And maybe what we think is going on is not. If we listen carefully, we hear at the end of the chapter about Job's daughters. These three beautiful young women, each of whom is assigned an inheritance, each of whom is named in the text. Now, in 2015, we think, well, that's fair. The girls should get something just like the boys. But recall, back then, in that day and age and culture, it all went to the sons. The girls only inherited something if there were no boys. And actually giving them names and identities? Whoa. Something is going on here. Expectations are being challenged and undermined. But that's not all. There's that interesting exchange between God and the friends of Job. The Lord is not pleased with them. They have not spoken of him truthfully as Job has. They need to make amends, offer sacrifice. But here is something interesting. They're supposed to do it through Job. Job is given agency and power and influence here. This is God. He doesn't need intermediaries, but he is making Job a partner. In this moment. And then there is a moment of what I can only now describe as scriptural inside baseball. Back in verse 10, you may have heard the word double. Job was given double what he had before. And to us, that sounds great. Good for Job. But those who knew their scripture well, and that would have been the people who were the original audience for this book, would have said, that is ringing a bell. That is familiar. There's something I know. Oh, yes, Exodus 22. A thief, when making restitution to the one he has robbed, is supposed to give double. This is pretty cheeky of the author of Job. Because who took everything away from Job? God. Now, when we read this book and all the chapters that lead up to this, particularly the ones immediately preceding today's lesson, we know that God has made the universe. God is in charge of all. Indeed, everything in creation is God's. So God can't steal from himself, can he? But there is here the lifting up of justice, that God will do the right thing, that Job was indeed correct in believing that this was an animating principle of the universe. God is just. God is fair. All of which leads us to verses 4 through 6. I'm going to read a slightly different translation. Hear now when I will speak, I will ask and you will inform me. Job there is quoting God. And he responds, I heard you with my ears, but now I see you with my eyes. Through his encounter with God, he's come to understand things differently, to develop a new comprehension of what the Lord is up to. Therefore, I recant and relent. Of dust and ashes. That's a little bit different, hugely in terms of meaning, from what we heard read this morning. The lesson we heard read from the lectern said that Job repented because he was dust and ashes. He was nothing and has given life to a view of Job abasing himself before God, of saying, I'm worthless, I'm nothing. But the Hebrew is ambiguous. And so it can be read, as I and others have suggested, I recant and relent of dust and ashes. Job is done sitting in front of his house, scratching himself and bemoaning his fate. He is turning from that. And he can only do that because he has come to understand the things he does not understand. That there are limits to his knowledge. That there are mysteries in the universe. That God is God, and we are part of his creation. One of the challenges for me in reading this final chapter of Job is this depiction of all being well and fine. The family and friends come to say, sorry about the bad stuff that happened, now we're going to have a party. And he finds himself with a beautiful new family and more wealth than he ever imagined and a long, long life in which to enjoy all of these blessings. But it seems monodimensional. As if all the bad stuff that happened before doesn't matter. And I think of the Job we've encountered. This complex, multi-layered individual who has thought about and discussed and explored concepts of suffering and evil and justice and the relationship between humans and their creator. And I'm reminded of an exchange I heard on the radio a couple of weeks back. And I apologize because I was driving the car, so I wasn't taking notes. So I don't remember the exact tragedy, outrage really, that this individual survived. It was a mother. And she lost a loved one in either Newtown or Aurora. And she said the events of that day are with her every day. She can't move on. But she was determined and has been since that horrible moment to move forward. And so she invests her life with meaning and fights for the things she believes in. Her particular issue now is to combat gun violence. I think of Job, and I imagine that there are nights when he awakes and remembers his first son who has died, and his heart breaks. I imagine there are sunny afternoons in which he sits in his vineyard and he remembers the days when he sat in the dust and fought his affliction and tried to make sense of the unfairness of it all. Job is able to carry on, because God has not given him happiness, but wisdom. Job is able to look at the totality of his life and all that has happened, and is able to chart a way forward. The anatomy of the happy ending of Job consists of this: a story well told, with characters who come alive, whose fate matters to us. They're people with whom we can identify. And there was a great climactic moment. It's not a restoration. Instead, it is a refounding. A refounding of the relationship between God and Job. Think about how those two were portrayed at the beginning of the book. Everything was fine, hunky-dory for Job. Life was good. He was on cruise control, enjoying his many blessings. And then there's God up in his heavenly council, engaging in what seemed like some kind of cosmic bull session, the kind of things we used to have in dormitories. And the advocate, the Satan, says, "Why don't we play around with Job here a little bit to see just how faithful he is?" The author of Job has not portrayed God in the most impressive light there. But by the end of the book, both Job and God have grown. They are deeper and richer and fuller portrayals. Job now has a wisdom and experience he did not have before. He has a perspective that helps him begin to grapple with his loss and his pain. And he has a tremendous conviction. For you will notice that while he says to God, he offers a confession, and this is not an admission of guilt, but a theological assertion. "There are things I do not understand, and now I am seeing where before I only heard." He never says, "God, I was wrong to raise these issues with you." He never says, "God, I should not have raised my hand." And so Job maintains the tradition of Abraham who stood up for the people of Sodom and Gomorrah despite all their failings. He follows in the footsteps of Moses, who argued with God, who was so angry with the Israelites that he was going to destroy them in the desert. Job now speaks with conviction. And what of God? Oh yes, we have the God who spoke from the whirlwind, majestic, awe-inspiring. This is the God of the Old Testament. And I do not mean the stereotypical version of a wrathful, vengeful God. I refer here to a God who is indeed the creator of the universe. This Almighty Lord respects Job and talks with him and does justice by him. Hollywood happy endings are make-believe. Wise guys like me can stand up here and criticize movies for not being perfect. Lord knows I can never make a movie. But still, I'm a viewer, so I can complain. I can ask George Lucas, you had a good movie in the first place. Why did you have to go edit them and make them better? I can think back to the places where I enjoyed these movies as a youth. Oh, when I was a young teen, the Stanley Warner was the place to go. This is a real-life movie palace. It's gone. They tore it down. Hollywood endings are ephemeral. But the happy ending that we see here in Job endures. And it lasts. Because it's not a Hollywood happy ending. It's a divine happy ending. It's an ending that is crafted and shaped and informed and enlivened and animated by the God who has made us and holds us and loves us.